Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, March 10th. I'm Ray Graff. Summer right around the corner, you know, and if you like to roll the windows down and go for a joyride in a car, truck, motorcycle, even RV, you want to make sure it's running well. And here with automotive tips is Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber & Fricke in Hoosick Falls, New York. We welcome your car calls at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Always a popular show, so call early. It's a good plan. Otherwise, you could be left on the line, and no offense, that's the way it goes. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email address if you want to drop us a line that way. But the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, your car calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff on the program today to answer your automotive maintenance and repair questions. Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, New York. It's an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for more than 30 years. The number to call if you have a question is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, how are you, sir?
Great, great. Good to be here.
Nice. It's getting to be that time of year when you start thinking about getting the nice car out and driving.
It felt like that yesterday.
Yeah.
There was motorcycles out.
Yeah.
I could hear them roaring by. I was a little bit envious.
Right in your neighborhood, it's a fairly slow...
Well, we have Route 22 that goes right past the front of the shop, so there's a lot of traffic there.
But I can't see you going over 30 in that neighborhood. I've been over to your shop.
You shouldn't go over 30, but I've seen some guys rip down the street pretty fast.
That's amazing. Did you get the Riviera out yet?
No, but you know what? I have the batteries on tenders. I kind of moved my trickle charge around, and I'm already thinking about getting some more interesting cars to drive out.
All right. Beside the 65 Riviera.
Yeah.
What other interesting cars would you drive?
Well, I don't think I drove this down here, but I have a 67 Chevelle.
Oh my heavens! You don't want to drive that around.
396.
Yeah. 7 miles to a gallon.
It's pretty bad, but it's pretty fun also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now when you ride one of these oldies, and it's been a long time since I've driven a car that was made in the 60s, you have to put the additive in for the lead?
Yes. Yeah. What I do is I run 91 ethanol free in all these old cars with carburetors.
Right.
And you can get it at a couple of places nowadays over.
Yeah. I even saw 93 ethanol.
Really? Yeah. Somebody told me about that. And yes, I do put the additive in it. I put some octane booster because the Chevelle is a kind of a built engine with high compression, and also the lead substitute. It just kind of cushions the valves.
Now, the high compression engine, and I have had a couple of cars where you need to put high test in because of the high compression engine. What happens when you don't put the high test in one of those?
In an older car, non-computerized, you start to get that pinging detonation sound, that rattling like marbles in a can.
I haven't heard that in ages.
No, it's over. You don't really hear it anymore because computers and knock sensors take care of it. And engines, the combustion chambers are much more efficient and capable of handling it. But it can be very detrimental to the engine. It can do damage.
When you hear that ping, and I remember it well now from a 73 Caprice Classic, what's going on?
The fuel is starting to combust way before the piston is up to the top and ready for a power stroke. So it's called pre-combustion or detonation. So it's almost, and I wouldn't quite say exploding, but the burn has started way too soon. And it hammers on the piston. It's like a little kickback inside the cylinder.
Gotcha. Our guest today is Gordon Fricke. It's Automotive Maintenance and Repair on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. And the line's already starting to load up. So let's go over to John in Shandaken. John.
Yes, hi. Here's my situation. I have a 1995 Honda Civic TX. Now, I need the backing plates for the rear drum brakes and also the rear trailing arms. Now, the problem is Honda doesn't stock those parts anymore because of the car's age. Also, they're not available new on the retail market. So I tried a couple of salvage yards, one in Texas and one in North Carolina, for the backing plates, but both times they sent me the wrong parts. So basically what I was calling up today is kind of a last-ditch effort to see if Mr. Freaky could recommend any reliable source of the used parts that I need for my car.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you're on the right track because that's about the only way you're going to source those parts, and you have to get them from the South. When you call these salvage companies back and explain that the parts are wrong, what do they tell you? They can't provide you with the correct one, or that's all they are showing?
Well, both times I paid by credit card, so it was fairly easy to obtain a refund. One was the one in North Carolina was quite cooperative. The one in Texas wasn't. But, you know, as I said, I was able to get a refund both times. But, you know, I was just calling up today to see if you knew of any reliable sources because, you know, both times I was struck out. You know, it's kind of, I feel it's hard to buy the used parts sight unseen.
Yeah.
You know, at long distance.
So I can't give out any names because I'd be advertising their services.
Right.
But I do get used parts periodically, and in a vehicle like yours, I will ask for it to come from a southern state, and they will find it and source it from down there.
Mm.
I don't know if he can get a hold of us somehow, and I can give him the name of a company.
Yeah,
you know?
Can, yeah. John. You can email us, and we will put you in touch with Gordon. Is that all right?
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot. Or you can just check our page, Vox Pop, WAMC.org/VoxPop, and the link will be right there. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. Andy in Pittsfield is up. Andy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 2011 Mini Cooper R60. It's a 6-speed base model, and it's got 118,000 miles on it. I always use 93-octane gas, and I use Tecron fuel additive and every other gas fill-up. My question or query is, last week I was driving west on the Mass Pike coming over from Springfield home, and I went across the Warrenoco Bridge and hit that big, monstrous 6-mile hill and immediately lost all sorts of power. Had to downshift into fifth gear, and by the time I got up to near the top, I was going about 55 and fourth, getting ready to go back into fifth.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really running too rough, but it's running nicely. I'm just at a loss.
Yeah. I know the hill. I've been up it many times.
Oh, yeah.
Loaded with cars sometimes. Any check engine light on?
No.
No, because that's usually the first stop, is to see if the computer has recognized something going wrong with the engine management system that could be robbing your power. What I would do is get the car scanned with a shop that has the European software, not just generic. If you go to an auto parts store, they can only read the codes that are affecting emissions. But if you go to a shop with European software, they can dig into the module. And there could be some telltale codes going on in there that haven't turned the light on.
Gotcha.
The usual things that come to mind, and you may have already been there and checked it, but condition of the air filter and the presence of, let's say, mice or rodent nesting in front of the air filter that gets sucked into it. Now you have a partially plugged air filter that wasn't plugged, you know, 5 minutes ago or a day ago.
Yeah.
And that won't generally...
Well, mouse...
Yeah.
Well, a mouse did eat my Prius a couple years ago, so...
We see it all the time. It's very common. So I would be checking basic things like the intake track, make sure there's no mouse nest material in there, check the air filter. You're doing the right thing with the fuel additive and the gasoline. Other things, you know, condition of the spark plugs. Just if your general maintenance is all up to date... You got to dig in a little deeper, and I would start there.
Does that have a tachometer on it?
Oh, yeah, sure it does.
And yep. What is that showing when you lose power, Andy?
You know, I try and just feather it so I'm not busting it up, but the tach doesn't change at all, you know, while I'm shifting up or down. You know, when I lose power, you know, the tachometer moves accordingly.
Yeah.
So you're a good driver is what you're saying.
I've been driving a very long time, all sorts of things with wheels and without.
Good for you, man. All right, listen, we'll have to take a break. Well, good luck with that one. 800-348-2551 is the number. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and it's Automotive Maintenance and Repair today. We'll be right back. Fox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest today. Before we get back to the calls, I always wanted to ask you, not counting current production models, what was the most difficult vehicle to work on?
That I've encountered?
Yeah.
You mean as a make and model?
Well, just, yeah, without getting sued.
I just put an alternator on a Saab 9.5 about 3 weeks ago, and that was terrible.
Really?
It's buried. You have to remove a million things to get it out, and the factory tells you to take it out through the bottom by removing the front of the exhaust, which was not going to happen. Too old, too rusty, too many broken bolts.
Right.
And I remember doing one some years ago where you could sneak it out the top by removing a couple of things, but that was like a 5 or 6 hour event just to change an alternator.
Oh my God.
That wasn't any fun.
And you can't use the book to do that because you're going in a different direction, right?
Yeah, they're telling you to take it out this way, and you're looking, saying, no, I'm not going to do that. It's going to be bad news taking it out that way.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to think beyond the manuals because they're factory manuals, perfect conditions, no rust, no northeast winters. Factory workshop with all the white coats. You know?
Our guest today is Gordon Fricke. It's Automotive Maintenance and Repair. 800-348-2551 is the number. And Adrian in New Paltz is on. Adrian.
Hey, hi there. Hi. 2007 Hyundai Entourage. Nice minivan. It's been giving me great service. 145K on the odometer. And finally, my inspection last year in December coughed up the catalytic converter blues. Ray knows the chords for that song,
sure,
of course. The O2 sensor and all that good stuff. So I've been nursing it along. I poured in one of those $25 bottles of stuff, and I got my check engine light to shut off. So I'm in good shape now. But I just thought if you had any other tips to help clean that thing out, or nurse the thing along. I'm not due for inspection in New York until December, so I've got all summer to fool with it.
Yep,
that's a lot.
That's
a lot of $25 bottles of stuff. I'll tell you that between now and December.
Well, my mechanic said don't do it more than like every 3-4 months. They said it's not like you want to do it all the time, and they advised me to do the mid-grade gas. I was wondering that was another part of the question. Should I stick with mid-grade, or should I go with premium? Anything to help clean that old catalytic converter out.
Right. So what happens is the catalytic converter is made up of a honeycomb, like a grid material that's coated with some precious metals. And those metals react with the exhaust going through them, and it's a chemical reaction and a change. It changes the pollutants into other substances that are okay or better than what's coming out. Eventually, that catalytic converter, in effect, wears down, and it just can't clean anymore. The additive that you put in it is there to hopefully remove any film of deposits that's preventing what's left of it to do its job.
Yeah.
Once you've got it as clean as it can be, it can only operate to a certain point, and the computer watches it. And then it turns on your light when it feels the catalytic converter efficiency is below minimum.
Right.
Now, that's a threshold set by the car manufacturer and EPA. And Subaru had a problem years ago. The light was coming on way too soon.
Yeah.
And the government allowed them to reprogram the threshold. But what you're doing is all you really can do, aside from making sure there are no air leaks in that exhaust system. Because a false air, wrong air, getting into the exhaust, particularly in front of or directly behind the converter, fools the sensors. Then the computer doesn't know the difference, and it turns the light on saying, hey, we're not cleaning up the air properly. So it could be a gasket leaking, a rusty exhaust pipe, a broken stud or bolt somewhere that holds the pipes together. So that's worth your mechanic looking over very carefully at some point.
But all of those wouldn't show an O2 sensor service light,
they,
right?
They could turn the light on for catalytic converter efficiency,
okay.
PO420 or PO430.
And the complicated, my mechanic says you'd have to look it up and really get in there because some of these Hyundais had a two-piece and some of them had a three-piece system. So
right. That's
a good point, is that maybe I've got an air leak somewhere in the vicinity of that CAT converter and that could be throwing off the O2 sensor, yeah.
Very quick, I had a Toyota pickup years ago, check engine light on, PO420, which is catalytic converter. Everything tested okay. The truck didn't have giant miles on it. Had an exhaust leak, but way down from the converter. I mean, I'm talking back by the rear wheels.
Yeah.
And I said to the owner of the vehicle, I said, your exhaust system is rusted through way, way back by the muffler. It should be replaced regardless. I'm curious to see if it's going to affect this check engine light. Put a new exhaust system on it. Light never came back.
Wow.
The leak was that far away.
Wow.
So that's something to definitely consider.
Adrian, thanks for the call. Gordon Fricke is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. And Rick is in Pittsfield. Rick, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. Since we're on the topic of too old and too rusted, I have a 1998 Mercury Mountaineer that is just being used at this point to plow my driveway. And so my question is, this winter, the rear drive shaft broke. I can't actually even get, it's so rusted, I can't get the universal joint in the front, the pin to come out. But my question is, if I run this thing, which I did for part of the winter, just on forward wheel drive and totally abandon the rear wheel drive, how bad is that on a low use stress on the remaining of the engine and the system?
Well, it's funny you say that because there was a motorhome company a long time ago, probably 15 years ago, that I encountered. They were making motorhomes out of Ford E350 four-wheel drive vans.
Yeah.
And what they cleverly did is at the transfer case, they took out the back drive shaft because this was going to be a front-wheel drive camper. So you had low platform, you had low floor in the back. They capped the transfer case, ran the power forward from the drive shaft to the front axle, and put CV axles in it, and they ran these things in front wheel drive only, which was traditionally a rear wheel drive vehicle with shift in four wheel drive.
Hmm.
So your Mountaineer is not as heavy as a F350, but it's got an old school transfer case in it. If the vehicle is that much of a quote beater at this point, what do you got to lose?
Well, you make a point.
Try
right.
It.
The question is, am I going to somehow just throw a rod or, I don't know, do something if there's too much stress in the front?
But no, it's not going to hurt the engine. It's just going to put a little more strain on the front end because there's no rear drive helping it. But, you know, remove the drive shaft in the back. You got to plug that transfer case off so you don't lose the gear oil out of there or keep the yoke in it. You know, keep that yoke in there. And, why not?
Any suggestions for pulling the universal? I mean, it's just rusted solid. The spring that holds it corroded to the actual universal, so I got a piece of the spring out, but I cannot get it dislodged. I'm going to just potentially just cut the drive shaft really short.
Do it. Cut the drive. It's just a tube, so cut the drive shaft. You can do it with a hacksaw if you can get under there.
Wow, Rick, I think you got Gordon's attention there. You look like you're
sounds like
that.
A lot of fun.
Yeah. Number here is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. Greg is in Del Mar. Hello, Greg.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We went from old and rusted to new and busted. I got a 2017 Subaru Outback, and I'm having trouble. I put it in park, and my key gets stuck in the ignition. And I got I jiggle the steering wheel and it locks and that still doesn't come out. And then I got to start the car again and put it back in park. And I have to do this a few times in order to get the key out. And I'm wondering, what do I do?
Yeah. How many miles on it roughly?
42,000.
Oh, that's low. Yeah. So
yeah.
I've had a few people with that very same concern. Last one was a Forester. And what I discovered is If you're in the car and you put it in park and you turn the key to remove it and you're going to go to the lock position, that ignition lock wants to be pushed in towards the front of the car. It has to go down a ramp, and that's the sticky part on these. So what I did with this vehicle, and I've done it to a few others, is spray the ignition lock. You can do it with Lock Ease or a lock lubricant or WD-40. But this time, when you put it in park, turn the key to the left and then physically push in on that whole key, and you'll watch that thing go in about a quarter of an inch, and then it'll go more to the left and you can pull the key out.
Ah.
You have to be conscious of pushing it in every single time. And I think that'll get you by.
Thanks a lot. You know, and we have a Nissan among our other vehicles, and we drove it up to Maine, as we always do, last summer. Got into the house, the driveway, couldn't get the key out
for
the life of me. Turns out it was almost a gear issue. I had to hit the brake and just sort of rock it a little bit with the car off.
So maybe it hadn't fully gone into park.
That was it.
Yes.
That's another thing that maybe he can look at, Greg can. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Steve in Greenfield. Steve.
Yeah, how you doing?
This is Steve.
I have a 1973 Boatback Riviera.
Wow.
All right.
And I took it out for a spin yesterday. Such a nice day. I tried to ignore that there might be salt on the road. I've had it a couple of years, and I noticed sometimes when you get it up to speed and you accelerate a little bit, you get a little tapping there. And I'm wondering if that's lifters and if it's got hydraulic lifters or valve lash or something to make an adjustment on them.
So it's usually
when you're going, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you think it's definitely clatter from the engine?
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. It could be, you know.
How many miles on that car? Do you know
about
accurately?
About 84,000.
Yeah.
That's what's on the odometer.
Yeah. So does it only do it sporadically because you don't drive the car very often?
Yeah, a lot of times I just drive it up to the cruise nights, but, you know, yesterday was so nice. I went around a little 30-mile drive, and it's been doing it since I have it. I'm not like, trying to do 0 to 60 burnouts or anything with it. So
this is what I do with cars of that vintage. That's got a 455 in it.
Yeah.
Big Buick engine.
Yeah, it does.
And that engine is of the vintage that likes a 2050 weight motor oil, which is really super thick by today's standards. Mm. But what I have some old cars, and I run a high zinc 2050 motor oil in those cars. And sometimes it's termed racing oil, but it's high zinc, which is for your flat tappets, which you have. And the thicker weight is good for those big loose tolerances.
Yeah.
Give it a fresh oil change. Use a very high quality filter. And you definitely want a filter that's okay with high zinc oil. Some of the new filters don't like it.
Ah.
K&N makes one, and here I am telling a brand.
That's all right.
But there are some brands that definitely cater to the old engines and the vintage motor oil. And that combination there and some driving might calm those lifters down, if that's the tick you're hearing. That's what I would do first.
Right. And although, I changed the oil in October before I put it away for the winter.
What'd you put in it?
1040 in it.
Yeah.
1040.
Yeah. I would do the 2050. I would bite the bullet, even though you just changed it in the fall.
More expensive?
Yeah, a little bit, because it's, you know, quote, high performance oil.
Right.
But I would do that.
Is that synthetic or is that real oil?
No, you don't need to put synthetic in that car. You can get conventional.
Right, but it's regular conventional 2050?
Exactly. High zinc formula. And get a quality filter, something that's going to handle that high zinc oil, and see what happens. And whatever.
Right, because I've seen some you know, things on YouTube where people buy a filter. I'm not going to say the names, and they cut them apart, and they're all cardboard inside.
Yeah, there's an orange one out there that has created a lot of fury on the internet.
Really?
So watch out for that one.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm on the air.
Right.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking of.
Whatever you do, don't get that back window broken out of that car. That's the glory of that vehicle. You know the window, Ray?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Corvette-esque. There's one down the road for me that's on the side of the road. and I stopped. You know, it's a parts car. The front windshield's gone. The side window's gone. It looks like a wreck. And I'm like, I'm thinking $300-$500, but the guy wants like $1,500 for it. I'm like, I don't know. It's not my year either, because I could tell them apart. Like the 71s have the louvers in the trunk, and then the 72s don't have the louvers, and the license plate are offset. Same, and mine's in the middle, so, you know.
Same back glass, though. That's a valuable item.
Same back glass.
Yeah, the boat tails had the same glass.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot. Good luck. He's into it. He's definitely into it. Good for him. Well, let's grab another call or two here before the next break. We go to Beth in Schenectady. Beth.
Hi. First, as the caller a few calls back, I drove an 89 Honda until 2016, and sometimes you can find parts in dealerships in Canada. So if he wants to.
Okay.
And if you spend less than $100, there's none of that, whatever that is, you know, the import tax, we'll call it.
Excise or whatever,
there you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I used to do. So I was going to – I have a newer car now, new to me anyway. And so is there – I know you're not supposed to put the catalytic converter cleaner in or the injector cleaners in that often. I do it like once or twice a year. And I hear there's a brand out of a – that's only dealers carry – is that something familiar
to
you?
The dealers and repair shops sometimes have professional packages where it's in bulk and you inject it or spray it in with their equipment. But you can buy absolutely top quality stuff at the auto parts stores that you pour in the tank.
Yeah.
And
right. Well, that's what I've been doing, and this because I spent so much money, I just was trying to make sure I. You know, before not to tempt fate, probably something else that happened before that check engine light comes on, but knock on wood. So I was looking for the literal best quality stuff I could get my hands on to put in there when I do.
Yeah, there's some good stuff.
Do you say any of the auto parts store stuff, or is there something in particular?
No, all your name brand auto parts sell. It's in a black bottle, and the chemical is Tecron. That was a chemical devised by Chevron. And you can. There's different size bottles. There's a 20-ounce...
Tecron?
Tecron.
Yeah.
T-E-C-H-R-O.
Oh, Tecron. Yeah, yeah, okay.
And you can put smaller...
And no more than once or twice a year, I hear?
I put it in my vehicles every oil change, which is a good interval, and sometimes that's only two or three times a year.
Yeah.
You can also
I do mine a lot because it's a stick, and I'm a new stick driver, so I've been changing my oil quite frequently. So Tecron.
Yeah, and you can get smaller quantities to put in more often, smaller bottles.
Right.
So that's good stuff.
It won't hurt the engine?
Not if you don't overdo it. Just read the label. It'll tell you.
Yep. Beth, thanks a lot for the call. One more here before the next break, and let's go to John in Catskill. John.
Hello, guys. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. I've got a 2007 Chevy Colorado. It's the four-wheel drive with the five-cylinder engine. Mm-hmm. And basically what's been happening is I have remote key fobs for it, and they've slowly but surely one stopped working completely, even though the battery's new. The other one only works when I get near the door. And I'm wondering if the body control module might have something to do with it. And the other thing is that basically I went into a store, came back out, went to start it. It would crank over, but it wouldn't start. And then later I tried it again, and it started right up.
Well, the body control module is in charge of those functions, and it does receive the signal from your key fob. It's a radio RF signal, radio frequency signal. You can get those fobs tested to see if they're putting out enough of the frequency. You get them tested at a repair shop. Most places that have tire monitoring service equipment can test key fobs. Going deeper requires more equipment and repair shops or dealerships to check that module and its inputs and outputs and all that. So it gets very computerized and very deep pretty fast. But test the fobs, make sure the batteries are brand new in them, and start from there.
Okay, and then one more thing is the dealership said It's got 150,000 miles on it. They say I should flush and replace the transmission fluid, and the same with brake fluid.
Yeah, it's definitely a good idea.
Right?
Yes. Yep. They're on track with that.
All right, John, we'll have to take a quick break here. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We'll be right back. Today, I'll tell you what, Gordon, our new producer Jackie Orchard doesn't even know what a cruller is. What's that? How do you not know what a cruller is?
They don't sell them at Starbucks.
Well, yeah,
my daughter's going to hate me for saying that.
They don't sell crullers at Starbucks?
I don't think. Maybe they do. I don't know.
Well, anyway, she does a good job, but she doesn't know anything about crullers. This email came in from Tula. I just bought a used red color, always important for click and clack. Well, it's not click and clack here. 2016 Honda Fit. 25,000 miles, automatic shift. Whenever I stop at traffic light or for other reason and keep the car in drive, it sort of makes a clacking sound. The sound stops when I get going or change to neutral. Is that normal for an automatic shift? I used to drive a standard shift, and that is from Teresa.
My guess is she's probably got an exhaust shield rattling.
Yeah.
And they sometimes only rattle at certain times, particularly at idle loaded, sitting at a light in gear.
Yeah.
And it gives you just that little bit of a vibration and a resonance and a rattling. The minute you speed the engine up, the rattle's gone.
Yep.
That's my guess.
All right.
Yep.
This one is from Aaron in Greenfield. Sometimes, first thing in the morning, when I shift my 04 Honda Odyssey into reverse after sitting overnight, the transmission will pop roughly into gear. Is this damaging the internal components, and what can I do to prevent this?
Yeah, 04 Odyssey. Wow.
That's a Honda?
Yeah,
okay.
And they had some serious transmission problems in the early years because my wife and I lived through one.
Oh, boy.
And it went through three transmissions.
Okay, well, you can fix them.
I still had to pay for them.
Oh, and transmissions are not cheap.
Horrible.
Really?
But I'm not saying she's got a transmission problem there, but...
it could be.
Always check the condition and level of the fluid first thing.
All right.
Yep.
Fair enough. This one is from Mark, and then we'll get back to the phones. Mark writes, with so many different tires to choose from, all season and whatever, snow and everything else, how can the average Joe figure out the best all-season tires to purchase?
Yeah, it's a very good question because all-season sounds great, right? Do anything with it.
Yep.
Climb Mount Everest. Go down to Miami Beach at 102 degrees. They kind of try to clump everything into one tire. And some all-seasons tire do a lot of things very well. There's so many out there to choose from. Consumer Reports is a source to look at, you know, when they're doing tire sampling. It depends on your vehicle and your purposes. If you are driving a sport utility and you occasionally go camping, hiking, or on some maybe forest roads, get one that's got a higher traction rating with a more open tread that gives you better off-road traction.
Oh.
If you're doing nothing but city commuting and freeway driving, get one with a tighter tread with a higher tread life expectation and suit your purposes that way.
You know, I was always skeptical. To me, a tire was a tire. And you remember well, the Nissan had basically bald tires. And I won't say the name of the brand, but the brand that you had suggested for me has turned out to be such a beautiful tire.
It was an intro. It's an old company, but they had just brought this particular model out, and the price was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And this particular one comes with a road hazard warranty that's not built into the price or charges you extra, which is very rare.
And I got to tell you, it just it makes the driving experience so much better. I never even thought about
tires
it
are everything. They really are. Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Mary in Catskill is on. Mary. Hello. Hello, Mary. Are you there? Oh, I hear a signal. Is Mary dead? Hello, Mary. Try it one more time. All right, if Mary calls back, we put her right at the front of the line, okay? All right, sorry about that, Mary, and I hope you're okay. Let's go to Christian in Otis. Christian, you're on.
Hi. I got a question. My wife's Honda Accord LX 2004, the rear drum cylinder broke in the driver's side. So what I did is I replaced the whole drum set with a kit on both sides in the back. And I checked the pads in the front. They're fine. They're pretty new. But ever since that issue with the cylinder and I replaced them in the back, when we brake on that car, the pedal goes all the way to the end and it barely brakes. And I bled all four brakes multiple times and I just can't figure out what is going on. And the fluid level is fine. I can't figure out what it is.
Yeah. Are you sure, first of all, this is a drum brake set up in the rear of the car, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So the brake shoes need to be adjusted properly. So those shoes have to be wound out so they're making very close or very almost touching the drums. If the if the adjustment's way out of whack, you'll get that low pedal. And a lot of times if you pump it three or four times, you'll get a good pedal and you'll say, wow, where'd that come from? Another telltale sign of misadjusted rear drum brakes is when you pull up on your parking brake, your handbrake on that car, if that lever goes all the way to the top and nothing grabs, your adjustment is out of whack in the drums, not the parking brake.
Mm.
So let's say your shoes are adjusted properly and your parking brake works great. You still have air in the system. And on some vehicles, there is a left and a right wheel cylinder, and the orientation of the bleeder screw can change, and you'll never get all the air out of it because the bleeder is actually below the inlet. So you need to check your parts to make sure if there is a left and a right rear wheel cylinder, you have them on the correct side of the car. Check your adjustment, and bleeding is still going to be an issue.
Did you get any of that? I certainly didn't, but I hope you did, Christian. Thank you for the call. It's like you're speaking Mandarin sometimes. I have no idea what's going on.
Maybe I went too fast, Ray.
I think he understood, though. That's the main thing.
I think he caught it, yeah.
And really, that's all that counts. I'm just sort of just minding the store. Susan in Egremont. Susan, you're on.
Hi, guys. This is a question between my sister and I. We're both Audi owners. She tends to buy new ones and then flip them every 3 years. And I'm driving my 2004 Audi All-Road 2.7 turbocharged that I love to death.
I have the same car.
She's willing to put gas in hers that's like 87. And I'm always at the other end of the spectrum, 93. And she says, no, they're good cars. They can take it.
Yeah.
You'll know, Gordon.
And I'm just wondering whether these days, because she seems to feel that their gas is clean, it's good, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I think it does. I mean, my baby gets the best because she's my baby. So I'm hoping you can clarify this for us.
I'm with you, and I have the identical car you just described.
Oh!
Identical. And I just hit a deer with it two weeks ago.
Man.
And it pushed.
No, I hit one in October.
Yeah, it pushed the.
But mine's fixed. Well, it's back on the road.
Yeah, I'm in the process. It pushed a bunch of stuff in the front end and broke a bunch of plastic. But anyway, so I know the car 100%, and you are the correct one of the two.
It's high compression?
Okay.
It's turbocharged, too. Your Quattro is twin turbo, two turbochargers. So it's a stressed engine. And if you flip the gas lid open, it'll tell you the minimum octane requirements, and it's going to be European standards. I don't know if it talks about American, but you need to put 91 in the car. You don't have to go any higher. You can if you like, but you need to maintain a 91 octane in that car. And what is your sister's car?
She drives an A6.
What year is her car?
I don't know. It's an A6, and she likes them big and new.
Okay. They have started to make some of them that did not require the 91, although I got a feeling hers still does require it. Open the gas lid, see what it says on the plaque that's stuck to the inside of the gas door.
Is chosen to ignore that.
Oh.
She says it can take what it's a good car. It can take whatever I put in it.
You know, my mother's probably listening right now, and she has driven Audis for years, and her son has always said, put 91 octane minimum in the car, And then one day, the guy that pumps the gas at the Citgo station, I was talking to him one day. He said, "Oh, by the way, your mother's not putting a premium in that car all the time. Did you know that?" I said, "Well, I'm not going to say that you told me that, but I'm going to ask her the next day." So, yes, you need to keep, you know, periodically, if you can't get it, you can't get it, and you put whatever the pump has in it. But for normal driving, that car should get the 91.
All right, set your sister straight now, Susan.
Well, I don't know whether I'm going to. She is, after all, my sister. I just wanted to clarify for me that I was doing it right.
Well, thank you for the call. Hey, quickly, before we go to the next call, disabuse me of my sort of mental image of how twin turbos work. I always thought, now you said it taxes the engine. I always thought this was a passive system that just took air and funneled it through.
It is. It doesn't tax the engine. It just adds more stress to it because you're pumping air to the intake of the engine under pressure. And that air gets hotter and it raises the pressures in the cylinders and makes a little engine produce a lot of power.
Yeah.
But in the case of this car that the last caller had, it's a V6. So there's a little turbocharger on each side of the engine, on each exhaust manifold, that pumps the pressurized air back up to the engine to make more torque and more power.
Gotcha. Let's go quickly now to South Hadley, Massachusetts. Phil, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I've got a 2013 Hyundai Santa Fe. Speaking of turbos, it's got the 2.0 turbo. It runs like a top. It has 116,000 miles on it. Three preventive maintenance questions. Number one, manufacturer recommends that I change the plugs on it. I've yet to do that, but it runs like a top. So should I do that? Number two, are there any belts or chains on it that need to be replaced now that we're over 100,000? And I forgot my third question, but if you could take care of those two, I would appreciate it.
Right. Spark plugs, definitely. It's a miracle they last so long nowadays. Back in the 60s, 50s, even 70s, you had to replace them almost every year.
Yeah.
Engines are very efficient now, and the plugs last way longer. Here's the downside.
Mm-hmm.
As the plug wears, the gap widens, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. The coils can compensate for that up to a point, but they're screaming. They're straining to jump that spark. They're making 50,000 volts.
Okay.
So eventually you'll beat up the coils and end up replacing the ignition coils. So, yes, do the plugs for sure. Belt. The only belt that engine has is on the outside that runs your accessories, so that's easy to look at with a flashlight. If it's the original, it's got to be time to replace it. That's big miles on a serpentine or a drive belt. That engine is cam chain driven internal, and my big recommendation to everybody is change your oil regularly because that cam chain relies on the engine oil. And when the chain stretches and wears and the guides fail and the belt or the chain comes off the sprockets, the engine's history.
Mm. All right, Phil, thank you very much for the call. Quickly over to Lydia in Hillsdale. Lydia, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 2015 Subaru Impreza. Sort of a weird thing happened. I turned on my car, the ABS light, the traction control light, and the hill assist light all came on. I went to go get gas, turned it off, turned it back on, all the lights were still on, and I couldn't get it out of park.
Hmm.
And I was stranded for about half an hour just trying everything I could to get it out of park, and then all of a sudden it just came free.
Huh.
Did all the warning lights go out after that?
No. So I was on my way to work. I drove to work. The warning lights were still on, but I drive on the highway, and my cruise control didn't work. I was leaving work. I turned my car back on. None of the lights were on, and it's been working okay ever since.
Sounds like software, right?
I'm scared every time I turn my car on, then I'm not going to be able to get it out of park.
Yeah. What I would do is this. I would get it scanned because those codes are still in the history of the computer, and there's a possibility that you have a brake light issue or a brake light switch issue because that system requires the brake. Pardon me?
I think that those Subarus had a recall on those, right?
Regarding the brake light?
Yeah.
It's possible. The brake light switch does more things than just turn the brake lights on now. It signals the ABS system that you are trying to slow the car down. So it gives it a signal, okay, the owner's on the brake pedal right now, get ready. And to get the shifter out of park, the park interlock has to get a signal from the owner, driver of the car, that their foot is down on the brake pedal. So if you lost your ability to get out of park and all those lights came on, you may have a brake light switch issue occurring. And there could be, and that's easy. You know, that's not a big fix, but I would get it scanned fairly quickly so the computer doesn't ditch the codes if too much time passes and see what's going on there.
Thank you so much.
And make sure your brake lights are working. Have somebody look behind you to make sure when you step on the pedal, the brake lights work.
Lydia's question mentioned a hill assist light. What is hill assist?
That's just part of that program to, a lot of these cars will, if you're on a steep hill, you take your foot off the brake pedal, the brakes stay on so you don't roll backwards, even though it's an automatic. It's a hill holder is what Subaru used to call it on their stick cars. So I'm thinking that's part of her system there.
Oh, I'll be darned. Let's quickly go now. We only have a minute or minute and a half here. Matthew in Albany. Matthew, you're on.
Hi, I have a Volkswagen diesel, and I'm still driving it. I bought it new, and I'm wondering how long can I drive it based on the fact that I had it quote-unquote fixed for New York State. What should I get next? Diesel.
So the question is, can you just keep driving it?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, The cars that did get retrofitted became compliant. And when you go get the car inspected, providing the check engine light isn't on and it gets plugged in, it should pass and be fine. They've had to make the ones that stayed on the road EPA compliant. So I wouldn't worry about that at all.
This is about the litigation that happened a while back?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. What year is the car?
Yes. Hey, it's a 13.
Yeah, that was part of that diesel
scandal.
Where they altered the software to make the car pollute less during the emissions testing.
Well, I think that's where we will have to leave it. Gordon Fricke, thank you for being here. I didn't know you hit a deer. How much work do you have?
I don't know. I keep telling people I got about 20 hours worth of work to do on it.
Haven't gotten to it yet.
It's all in pieces right now.
All right, sir. Well, we'll see you next time. Hopefully, it'll be running by then. Yeah. Support comes from Temple Sinai, announcing their community Purim Carnival with family entertainment, costumes, games, and more. March 15th, 2 p.m. at Gavin Park, Wilton. SaratogaSinai.org for details. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services at a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years, BoydenandPerrin.com. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts, family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation services and deliveries, GeorgePropane.com. And C&H Architects, working with residential clients throughout the Berkshires and Hudson Valley to create a legacy of sustainable architecture designed for the next 100 years, CNHArchitects.com. Thanks again to Gordon Fricke for being here today. Thank you for listening, and thanks for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Jackie Orchard is our producer. Kayleen White took the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Stand by now for The Book Show.